I'm Mike Collins. Listener support powers the coverage from WFAE that you rely on in good times and bad. As reporters and producers keep you updated on the coronavirus and its impact on the community, we hope that you'll consider a donation to WFAE at WFAE.org or by calling 704-549-9000. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Healthcare has been a topic of political conversation for generations. Before, during, and after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, opponents warned of dire consequences. But once it went into effect, many Americans discovered they liked it. But now we face the greatest medical crisis in our history. The COVID-19 outbreak threatens to affect millions, and a large percentage of those may need expensive, critical care. Despite Obamacare, a high number of Americans still have no health insurance, and President Trump has decided not to reopen the health care exchanges to allow those without coverage to obtain it during this crisis. As the Affordable Care Act turns 10 while this pandemic unfolds, will this be the moment that Americans stop viewing health care for all through a political lens? Will this pandemic slow attempts to repeal the ACA? Here to explore that is Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Before joining KHN, she led NPR's coverage of the Affordable Care Act's passage and implementation and wrote Healthcare, Politics, and Policy A to Z. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Good to see and hear from you. Our radio audience can't see you, but I can for the first time. We're joined also by Jonathan Oberlander, Professor of Health Policy and Management at the UNC Chapel Hill Gilling School of Global Public Health and the Chair of the Department of Social Medicine in the School of Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you for being here as well.
Wonderful to be with you.
So, Julie, let me start with you. The Affordable Care Act extended opportunities to Americans to buy more affordable health insurance independent of their employer. It required insurers to cover people with pre-existing conditions. The act forbids lifetime dollar limits on medical care. It allowed parents to keep their children, their adult children, on their own insurance policy until the age of 26. It was viciously opposed by many prior to its passage. Some of those who originally opposed the bill discovered, as I said, they like it. So how would you assess the impact of the Affordable Care Act and that it's had on people's lives and on their ability to get and keep health insurance?
Well, about 20 million more people have insurance now than had it when the law was passed 10 years ago. It just turned 10. And you know, one of the big things that you didn't mention is the expansion of Medicaid to people with low incomes, although that became voluntary and not every state did it, as we well know. But going into this crisis, I think it's fair to say that the health system, as strained as it is right now, would have been strained even more and significantly more had it not been for the Affordable Care Act.
Republicans, Jonathan, have always opposed this plan. They have made more than 60 attempts to repeal it. President Trump has promised many times to repeal and replace it with something better. That hasn't happened. It has withstood so far two cases before the Supreme Court. There's another one right now that the Supreme Court is looking into. So why so much continued opposition to the Affordable Care Act when people clearly like this legislation? Not just people, but hospitals and doctors and clinics and other healthcare professionals. Why?
I think much of the opposition to the Affordable Care Act really has nothing to do with healthcare and or the Affordable Care Act, and is a reflection instead of broader partisan polarization in the United States. We live in a period where, as political scientists measure it, we have the most ideological polarization, the most distance between the two parties in Congress that we have had since right after the Civil War. And I really believe that Obamacare has been caught up in that larger partisan divide.
But correct me if I'm wrong, isn't Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, isn't it based on a Republican health care plan? Isn't it based on Mitt Romney's Massachusetts plan?
It is. It is largely modeled on the plan that Massachusetts passed just a few years before the Affordable Care Act. But of course, Massachusetts Republicans are not a general read on the Republican Party, nor in Washington, D.C.
So Republicans don't like Democratic policies and vice versa, and Republicans, particularly the president, the current president, really doesn't like the previous administration or the previous president, and this is sometimes called Obamacare, so that's a reason to get rid of it because it's his predecessor's policy. But an NBC News Wall Street Journal poll reveals that 10 years ago, when this bill just passed, 48% of Americans thought it was a bad idea. 36% said it was a good idea. Now, today, 42% in this Wall Street Journal NBC poll favored the ACA, only 35% oppose it. And polling by the Kaiser Family Foundation, Julie, finds a clear majority, 55% of the public views this now favorably. So clearly opposition to this is dropping away. Why hasn't that helped to firmly entrench the Affordable Care Act and make it something that Republicans really don't want to tamper with?
Well, it has actually more firmly entrenched it. And Senator Mitch McConnell, no fan of the Affordable Care Act, said at the very beginning of this Congress that he really had no intention of following up on the president's desire to continue to fight to repeal it, that he would rather work on things like prescription drug prices and surprise medical bills. So a lot of Republican elected officials have, in fact, acknowledged that it is likely here to stay. Although, as you mentioned, there is yet another existential threat in the form of another lawsuit brought by some conservative state attorneys general and governors and supported by the Trump administration.
So why is the United States, which we are repeatedly told is the greatest country in the world and has the greatest healthcare system in the world, why are we the outlier when it comes to universal health coverage and healthcare outcomes? Because we don't do as well in terms of outcomes as many other industrialized nations with universal healthcare, Jonathan.
Before I answer that, let me just add to what Julie said, which is really, if you look at the public support for the Affordable Care Act, the number one thing that has boosted public support of Obamacare is Republican attempts to repeal it. Because if you look at the first 7 years or so of the law, the public remained divided. The law was not particularly popular. In 2017, when Republicans were trying to pass repeal and replace legislation through Congress, and remember, it made it through the House and came up just short in the Senate, that was extremely unpopular legislation. It was extremely controversial to propose, as they did, that we erode protections for pre-existing conditions. And that really has boosted Obamacare's popularity. In terms of why we're an outlier, we don't really have a healthcare system in the United States. We have a non-system that doesn't make any sense. You would never design it this way. I always tell my students at Carolina that if I asked them to design the least efficient, least equitable, most expensive way for delivering health insurance they could, they probably couldn't outdo what the United States already has. So that's in a way why we perform badly on a lot of these outcomes. We're an outlier for political reasons. We have political institutions that have made comprehensive health reform difficult. And it's also the case that we have had strong interest group and stakeholder opposition to changing the status quo. And fear of government is in our political DNA, and that has at times complicated the push for universal health insurance.
So it's a combination of this fear of government and suspicion of government, and also this pull yourself up by your bootstraps lore that we have in this country, that if you work hard and do what you're supposed to do, you'll do well. But the other thing, it seems to me, would be capitalism. We seem to be driven in almost every sector of this country by, if it makes money, then it's a good thing. But there are other capitalist Western nations who seem to have at least done this piece of it socialistically. Has that no future in America, Julie?
Well, Japan is a very capitalist nation, and they have a much more sort of thoughtful healthcare system than we do. I mean, this is not to say, a lot of people think that every other country has sort of a British style socialized medicine system, and they don't. Most other countries have some sort of hybrid of public and private, but they're at least make sense logically. And our system just doesn't make very much sense logically. You know, perhaps this crisis will, you know, serve to crystallize some thinking of some people, you know, that maybe we should have a more streamlined way of letting the public and private sectors work together. That would be a good outcome. But right now, we have not been able to get over the political obstacles to getting to that.
Because people have met, older people have Medicare, and they seem to like that. And Bernie Sanders has been hammering away at this idea of Medicare for all. He sees that as the next step in this move to have universal coverage. And that coincides with the Kaiser Family Foundation's finding that Republican opposition is shifting away from Obamacare to the idea of Medicare for all. They're now certainly opposed to that. But there is also opposition, Jonathan, to Medicare for all within the Democratic Party and within of those who identify themselves as independents. Why?
Oh, that's right. And really, if we go back just a month ago, pre-COVID-19, the arguably the defining issue in the Democratic primary this year has been healthcare reform. And part of the party led by Bernie Sanders is for Medicare for all. And another part of the party now embodied by Joe Biden is for what's called the public option, which is a more incremental approach, really retaining the Affordable Care Act and creating a Medicare-like government plan that people under age 65 could buy into. And I think it's partly a division that's born of political calculation. And there are a lot of Democrats who believe that Medicare for all is just not politically possible. And that if you want to move towards expanded coverage, you've got to do something like the public option. And part of it is an ideological divide within the Democratic Party about the role of government versus private insurance.
Well, during this whole conversation for the last 20 years about doing something about healthcare, we've always heard that we don't want the government to decide what condition will be taken care of, or who they will decide who your doctor will be. But under Medicare, you can decide who your doctor will be, can't you, Jonathan?
Yes, absolutely. Medicare, and it's sort of an odd thing because we say we're a country that's skeptical of the government and skeptical of socialized medicine. And we have an example of Canadian style national health insurance right here in the United States, Medicare, that is extremely popular with its beneficiaries, where people do have a broad choice of doctor. And so a lot of the labels and stereotypes we have about quote unquote socialized medicine really are contradicted by reality, and not just abroad, but right here in the United States.
So the Affordable Care Act did not achieve universal coverage. 30 million Americans, I believe, still remain uninsured, although 20 million more people have insurance today because of the Affordable Care Act. Insurance companies are still in business. You can still choose your doctor. Hospitals and doctors and clinics are now being paid for a lot of the things that they didn't get paid for before because people couldn't afford to pay them. Now they have Obamacare, and the insurance will pay. So in addition to being beneficial to individual Americans, it's been beneficial to the medical and healthcare industry, hasn't it, Julie? Would they support this, or do they support it?
Absolutely. Well, they supported it in the beginning. That was one of the ways it got passed. I think what Democrats learned from the Clinton administration's failed effort was that you really need the healthcare industry on board because they are simply too powerful to overcome. So they got them all, you know, basically in the room, and they all signed off and they did support it. And, you know, part of the trade-off was that we will pay you less for some things, including Medicare, I might add, but you'll have all these, you know, extra insured people. So in the end, you'll make more money than you were before. And that's
proven to be true, right?
Mostly. I mean, you know, obviously in states that didn't expand Medicaid, that's a big problem because they got money cut, but they didn't get as many as the extra insured people as they were expecting. But yes, in general, the healthcare sector supported the Affordable Care Act. I should add that, you know, when Bernie Sanders talks about Medicare for all, he's not talking about the current Medicare program. He's talking about an entirely new program that would sort of ironically be called Medicare, because as you point out, Medicare is popular. But it would be very much different and very much more sort of government centric.
Julie Rovner is Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act in the on its 10th anniversary, which I think was last Monday, not today. I could be wrong about that. And also what the future of that looks like, given the pandemic that we are all experiencing now and what that might do to our attitudes about some sort of universal health coverage in America. Dr. Jonathan Oberlander is with us, professor of health policy and management at the UNC Chapel Hill Gilling School of Global Public Health, and Julie Rovner, who you know from NPR, but she is the chief Washington correspondent from Kaiser Health News and the author of Healthcare Politics and Policy A to Z. The New York Times reports, Julie, that for all of the ACA's success, over the last couple of years, the uninsured rate has started creeping back up. Why?
Well, partly because the Trump administration has worked extremely hard to make it as hard as possible for people to take advantage of some of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act.
Why? Because
they don't like it. They want it to go away. They could not make it go away legislatively. So they're doing everything they can administratively to weaken it. They're doing things like encouraging people to buy less expensive, but also far less comprehensive types of what are called short-term plans. They've cut outreach and assistance for people to sign up. You know, this latest decision to not reopen the exchanges with so many people losing their jobs. And indeed, if you lose your job, you do become automatically eligible to sign up under the Affordable Care Act. But it would have been much easier if they just reopened enrollment, then people wouldn't need so much documentation, which is going to be difficult for them. So they've taken lots of administrative steps, many of which have been challenged in court, but they've done a lot of things to try to undermine the Affordable Care Act, and we're starting to see the impact of that in more people without insurance.
Yeah, you can go to the exchange if you lose your job in this pandemic because of COBRA, and that will allow you.
No, that's actually separate.
That's separate. Okay, yeah. I'm sorry. So you have two options if you lose your job.
That's correct.
You can extend your health care for a certain amount of time under COBRA, and then you can go and officially go through the Obamacare Affordable Care Act exchanges. But there are a lot of people who may have not be in that situation. Gig workers, for instance, may not be in that situation. So why not open this to them, Jonathan? It seems to be not only, what's the word? I don't want to say inhumane, but let's just use that word for lack of a better one. But it also seems to be counterintuitive. I mean, this is going to cost a lot of medical facilities a lot of money when people flood these intensive care units without the ability to pay.
We've had a lot of gaps in our health insurance non-system for a long time. And what COVID-19 is doing is really exposing those gaps. And those holes in the system are becoming chasms. It makes absolutely no sense not to have another special enrollment period and open it up in the health insurance exchanges for people to sign up. And this really is vindictive. It really is personal, and it's partisan, and it's nothing more than that. And you mentioned the uninsured population going up, and with millions of Americans losing their jobs, and therefore many of them losing employer-based health insurance, that uninsured population is really going to increase. And of course, we should be thankful that the Affordable Care Act has options for people. And if you live in a state that has expanded Medicaid, as Julie said earlier, that'll be a really important option for people. Other folks can go into the health insurance marketplace. But the administration, as Julie rightly said, has really tried to make those marketplaces fail. And even in this time of national crisis, you sort of can see the reticence to buttress the marketplaces, which is really what the administration should be doing right now.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Julie. Insurance companies have made money as a result of the Affordable Care Act in enrolling more people and putting more people onto their rolls. They may be paying more money out, but is it offsetting? Are the premiums paid by this larger number of people offsetting the expenses?
In the aggregate, yes. I mean, obviously, it depends how you set your premiums and who you get, but generally, insurers are doing okay in the Affordable Care Act marketplace.
So, would they not like to see people? Would they, given the outlay of cash that's obviously going to happen with this pandemic, would they rather not have uninsured people enrolling at the last minute so they have insurance to pay for these critical care situations?
No, I think at this point, the insurance industry would like to have a broad reopening. Some people, remember, will give up some of these short-term plans and buy comprehensive plans instead. Not everybody who buys insurance, assuming that there's a broader opening up of enrollment. We should point out that 11 states have reopened. The states that run their own exchanges, I think all but one of the states that run their own exchanges, has reopened enrollment broadly. And the hope is that, you know, obviously more people will buy insurance than will get sick. But it is much easier, you know, the people who didn't buy insurance when they could have, or who bought insurance that they're now sorry about because it doesn't cover very much. Those are the people who are most hurt by not having a broad reopening. The people who lose their jobs and their job-based coverage, assuming they don't want COBRA, which is extremely expensive, but also comprehensive, can go to the marketplace and they can get insurance, but there are a number of documentation hoops that they have to jump through that may be difficult in this time where everybody is, you know, closed up.
So the president is on board with this state lawsuit that's before the Supreme Court that's attempting to end the Affordable Care Act, should the Supreme Court make that decision. Is this just optics then? If he's on board with that, would it just look bad to his followers if he allowed the exchanges to reopen? I mean, and if that's the case, could he be accused of choosing optics over saving lives?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, we still don't know why the administration has decided to do, you know, to not reopen the marketplaces. There was definitely under serious consideration. The president was asked about that lawsuit. I think it was last week. The days are kind of running together. And he did say that the administration still supports it because he insists that the Affordable Care could go away and they could pass something different instantly, which obviously has certainly not been the case so far. But even in, you know, the wake of this pandemic, the president himself has not backed off of support for eliminating the Affordable Care Act.
You've written extensively, Jonathan, about Medicare, the history of our struggle over national health insurance, including the ongoing conflicts over the Affordable Care Act. This pandemic is going to be unimaginably expensive, it seems to me, even as our economy is being trashed by this pandemic and by our efforts to contain the virus through the stay-at-home policy. How will our health care, our health insurance system be affected in comparison to those nations that have a national health care plan in place who are also affected by this pandemic?
Well, COVID-19 is of such a magnitude that it is overwhelming and straining hospitals and healthcare systems across the world. And that includes places like Italy that have very good healthcare systems, countries that have universal healthcare. Having said that, in those countries, what they can focus on is what is the appropriate public health response? How do we coordinate a national response to mitigate the pandemic? In the United States, in addition to trying to do that, and obviously we're having a lot of trouble coordinating a coherent national response, we have to worry about the fact that millions of Americans don't have any health insurance at all. And millions of additional Americans have health insurance, but they're underinsured. They don't have very good coverage. And at a time when really we're being told, and rightly so, that it's a collective responsibility to try and limit contagion, to try and mitigate this pandemic, that imperative for social cohesion is running up against the reality that we have never operationalized a right to health care in the United States. So I think it really has weakened our response. It has made us more vulnerable. And for millions of Americans, it puts them in a very difficult position.
And if you're trying to contain costs, it seems to me this is not the way to do it. If you do not have health insurance, if you don't have it through your employer, if you never opted into the Affordable Care Act, now you have this pandemic. And if you get sick or if you feel sick, you may be reluctant to see a doctor because of the expense involved in seeing a doctor. And if you get really sick and have to go into intensive care, you're on the hook for that amount of money. Is that going to deter people, Julie, from seeking the help they need, which would also help contain the virus?
Yes, that is the concern. And that's why the administration has been taking some steps to do this. And the last piece of legislation that went through Congress stipulated that testing for COVID-19 will be free. Presumably the government is going to be paying for this, not even the insurance companies, although a number of private insurance companies have tried to assure the administration that they will cover all costs, not just the testing costs, but the care costs associated with COVID-19. And one of the things that the administration said they were going to do, although we haven't seen the documents on this yet, is rather than reopen the marketplaces, they will take some of the money from that last piece of legislation. There was $100 billion earmarked for hospitals, and they'll use some of that money to pay for COVID-19 care for people who don't have insurance. Of course, if you then end up in the hospital and you have something that's not COVID-19, then you may be on the hook for a rather large bill because you still don't have insurance.
Even those on the Affordable Care Act have noticed that in some cases their premiums have risen over the last 10 years, that their co-pays and out-of-pocket expenses have risen over the last 10 years. Why is this happening, and has it actually worked to make healthcare more affordable?
Are you asking me or are you asking Jonathan?
Well, you can take it.
Well, there are a lot of reasons. The Affordable Care Act was more about coverage than it was about cost. There were a number of, you know, cost reducing, limiting the increase experiments through the Medicare program, because that's a large part of the healthcare system, but not that much on the private insurance side. We've seen much higher bills from doctors and hospitals and drug companies. So to some extent, the insurance premiums are a reflection of how much costs have been going up in the healthcare sector itself. And there are a number of efforts right now, bipartisan efforts, to do something about those spiraling costs. Because, you know, one of the things about our hybrid public-private healthcare system is that we basically let providers, to some extent, charge whatever they want to the people that they can. Most other countries have some sort of cost control mechanism that the United States does not have.
So the
Affordable Care Act has an affordability problem. There's no question it's achieved a lot in terms of ending insurance discrimination in this country, protecting people with pre-existing conditions, expanding insurance coverage. But if you're not very low income and you have to buy health insurance through the ACA's marketplaces, in a lot of cases, those plans are not very affordable. The premiums can be quite high. And more than that, the deductibles and the copays and the coinsurance can be extremely high. And so when you hear people talk about affordability issues in the Affordable Care Act, they are very much real, especially for the middle class. And one of the problems with the partisan fight over the Affordable Care Act is Congress has not acted to try and fix the problems in the law. There has been nothing in the last decade. Congress has agreed sometimes to delete parts of the law, but in terms of actually improving and strengthening the law to make it more affordable for middle-class Americans, there are policies you can enact. Congress has not taken any of those actions, and it's because of this impasse between Democrats and Republicans over the Affordable Care Act.
And I would assume that the fact that it's not as affordable as one would think with the name Affordable Care Act, that adds more arrows to the quiver that President Trump and other Republicans use when criticizing the Affordable Care Act and what it's done. Did the millions of people without health care during this pandemic give credence to Bernie Sanders' argument that it is, quote, impossible to believe that anyone can still think it's acceptable to continue with a health care system that leaves tens of millions of people uninsured? Are people hearing that comment now in the face of this pandemic, Julie, that may not have heard it a month ago?
I think so. I mean, I think people who go about their daily lives and don't really worry about getting sick, particularly younger people, are suddenly worried about getting sick. And that's making them think about health insurance. And they're seeing what's going on in, you know, hospitals and nursing homes and in hard hit parts of the country. And I think everybody is focused on healthcare in a way that they haven't been. Will that lead them to support of a more government system? I don't know. Will it lead them to think about the healthcare system in a very different way? I think absolutely.
Has the pressure been turned down to repeal this act in any way by the fact that people like the fact that they now have healthcare, that they can actually go to a doctor, by the fact that they can leave their child? And gosh knows, young people today getting out of college sometimes go home and live with mom and dad because they can't afford anything else. But even if they don't go home and live with mom and dad, they can stay on their insurance policy to the age of 26. People like that. They don't want their children to be sent off into the wind with no healthcare coverage. Has that lessened the pressure, Jonathan, to repeal it?
In some ways, yes. I think there are two different realities. There's Obamacare in terms of the sort of partisan conception of the law that has created a lot of vitriol and a lot of opposition. And then there's the Affordable Care Act, the real Affordable Care Act, which has no question a lot of problems and a lot of shortcomings, but also, as you've suggested, has a lot of policies that people like. And as Julie mentioned before, I think the law is more entrenched now than it was a few years ago. And I think, again, that Republican efforts to repeal and replace it have made it more popular. But we should not lose sight of the fact that despite the growing popularity over the last few years, there are still serious efforts to repeal the law through the courts. And who knows what this COVID-19 pandemic does to the schedule of the Supreme Court and their decision-making about this case. But there is a very serious legal threat to the Affordable Care Act hanging over the law. And it's unimaginable to me that the court would rule in the midst of this to deprive tens of millions of Americans of health insurance. On the other hand, we've had a lot of unimaginable things happen here over the last few years.
There have been a string of presidents, Republican and Democrat, who have proposed some form of health care coverage for all Americans. Correct me if I'm wrong. I believe it started with President Truman, but it may have been earlier than that. I don't know. So that means there has been bipartisan support down through the last 60 years for this, 70 years for this. Why are we still arguing over this? Why can't we come to some sort of agreement on this, Jonathan? Is it just in our DNA to not want this?
There are multiple reasons. There have been a lot of presidents, and Truman was the first American president to formally propose what today we would call single-payer national health insurance, but there hasn't been so much bipartisanship actually during the last 60 years. You did have Richard Nixon, a Republican, support universal health insurance that looked actually not that dissimilar from what Barack Obama ended up passing. But as I mentioned before, the partisan divide between the parties has grown much wider in the last three decades. And so part of the reason we're still arguing over this is ideologically the parties are further apart now, much further apart now than they were 30, 40, 50 years ago. That makes it very difficult. And again, we have that ideological anxiety about big government, and most Americans have been insured. And part of the resistance to healthcare reform is just the inertia. People who are well insured and stakeholders who do well in the current system worried about unsettling what they have.
Dr. John Oberlander is professor of health policy and management at the UNC Chapel Hill Gilling School of Global Public Health. He's here with Julie Rovner with the Kaiser Health News Organization. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about something that Jonathan mentioned a minute ago, repeal and replace, and where we stand with that. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act, its present, past, and future, and what the impact of this pandemic may be on our attitudes towards some sort of universal coverage in America. Julie Rovner has been reporting on the Affordable Care Act since its inception. She started doing it with NPR, and now she is the chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and the author of Healthcare Politics and Policy A to Z. She joins us from her home. Dr. Jonathan Oberlander, professor of health policy and management at UNC Chapel Hill Gilling School of Global Public Health. He joins us, I believe, from his home. I'm from my home. We're all social distancing here this morning. I want to talk about repeal and replace. Before we even started, we had a Twitter comment from Tim, who said, "Why do we all keep saying repeal and replace? In 10 years, I've never once seen a sincere attempt to outline a replacement. President Trump has promised more times than I can count to repeal and replace this horrible Affordable Care Act with something that is much, much better. But he's never been specific." Do Republicans, Jonathan, have a plan? Do any of them have a plan?
If by a plan we mean a plan that would cover as many Americans with as comprehensive protections as the Affordable Care Act has, the answer is no, and there's never been one. There have been Republican plans, and of course the House passed one in 2017. That plan had a lot of problems with it. And since that time, Republicans have not settled on another one.
And as I asked that question, Julie, you were mouthing the word no. if they don't have a plan, it can't be better, can it?
The Republicans coined the phrase repeal and replace, I believe, in 2011. And they've been talking about this, and we've seen white papers and we've seen talking points. But basically, and I've written about this a lot, Republicans have just as many internal divisions about what to do about the healthcare system as Democrats do. Democrats tend to fight between sort of incremental measures like the Affordable Care Act, which was a big incremental measure, and Medicare for All, which would be a complete overhaul of the nation's health system. Republicans also have divisions, not those divisions, but different divisions. Again, you know, that have to do with how little government you want. And therefore, Republicans have never been able to come together on and back a single plan. And they keep saying that they will, but it's now been 10 years and we have not seen that.
But if you're the president of the United States and you're one of your campaign positions 4 years ago, and it continues to be repeal and replace, and we're going to replace it with something better, and nobody has a plan, isn't that politically dangerous? Because what happens if you're successful at repealing? Then you can't replace it with something better. What does that do to you?
Well, that's what's going to happen if the Supreme Court overturns the law. Is there, you know, they keep saying they're going to have something ready. There's a task force within the administration to work on having something ready. But they were asked a number of times, you know, do you have some kind of contingency plan if the courts overturn this law? And the answer so far has been not that we're going to tell you about.
One argument for the Affordable Care Act was that it's going to make healthcare more affordable. That has not necessarily proven to be the case. Another argument would be that it would make people healthier because they have access to doctors and they can go for checkups and preventive care. Has that happened under Obamacare? Jonathan.
Well, the health effects of the Affordable Care Act and of any insurance, are difficult to measure. They're, if you look at recent studies around mortality, there is evidence that the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion in particular has resulted in lower mortality, has saved lives in the United States. And there are studies out there now estimating how many lives have been saved by the Affordable Care Act. In other areas, in terms of clinical outcomes and health outcomes, it tends to be more of a mixed story. And part of that is we don't have a lot of the data. And yet part of it, it's difficult to measure. And part of it is people's health is determined by many things, where they work, how they live, what they eat, what their income is, what their housing conditions are. And it's not determined solely by their health insurance status.
Were these rising costs of premiums and out-of-pocket expenses under the Affordable Care Act, Julie, were they an unintended consequence? Were they unanticipated? Is this because of some sort of profiteering now that so many people are on it?
Yes. All of those questions. I don't think it was caused largely by the Affordable Care Act, although to some extent, one of the things we've seen in the last decade is sort of the entrance into the healthcare sector of private equity and hedge funds and people basically whose raison d'etre is to make money. And there's a lot of money in healthcare. It's almost a fifth of the economy. So why not get in? And that's one of the problems we're seeing with some of these surprise bills is that a lot of these doctor practices are now owned by private equity firms who just want to get as much money as they can. We've seen it to some extent in the prescription drug sector where investors have come in who are not necessarily drug makers themselves, but they want to sort of get in on the profits. So that didn't really have that much directly to do with the Affordable Care Act, but we have definitely seen it. And, you know, that this spiraling rise in healthcare prices, not so much spending, has been something that I think was unanticipated and not addressed by the Affordable Care Act because I don't think it was happening to the extent that it is now.
And, you know, healthcare costs in the United States are always going up. It's like an escalator, a never-ending escalator, and it's always going up. But actually, the rise in healthcare spending, national healthcare spending in the last decade, is at a much lower level than was forecast when the Affordable Care Act was enacted. And Julie mentioned earlier some of the measures that the Affordable Care Act adopted in Medicare. And Medicare spending today is something like over $1,000 less expensive per person than was forecast when the law was enacted. So on the one hand, we do have a very serious affordability problem that goes far beyond the Affordable Care Act and into employer-sponsored coverage and rise of high deductible plans that a lot of Americans can't afford. premium increases. I think the average premium for family health insurance in the employer market is now around $20,000. So premium increases that employers have difficulty paying for. On the other hand, if you just look at the trajectory of national healthcare spending, that spending growth has been going up at a more modest rate than we thought it would a decade ago.
The profit motive, and we've heard presidential candidates talk about this, should healthcare be a profit center for a hedge fund or something else for hospitals, et cetera? And in other Western nations that have universal healthcare, in Italy, in France, in England, in Canada, in the Scandinavian countries, is profit a motive in healthcare? I'm not sure to ask that question of.
Well, there is, you know, not every country is, all of those countries have very different healthcare systems. So some of them do have profits, particularly in the prescription drug sector. I think less so in the actual provider and the doctor and hospital setting, but they're not all owned by the government or run by the government. There, many of them are private and they contract with the government, much as we do with Medicare right now. You know, our hospital sector, there's a lot of for-profit hospitals and there's some, you know, not-for-profit hospitals. And I think there are actually more not-for-profit hospitals than for-profit hospitals. So it definitely is a different type of thing. But I think we have more of the, because we spend so much more than other countries, there's more of an incentive for people who are looking for profits to come into the health sector. Whereas in other countries where they more limit how much they spend on healthcare in the aggregate, people who are looking for profits might go to a different sector.
The future of the Affordable Care Act remains uncertain because there is this lawsuit that will be winding its way through the Supreme Court. It's a challenge from certain states. What is the crux of the challenge, Jonathan? Because the Supreme Court has upheld the Affordable Care Act twice. The last time, the Chief Justice was the deciding vote in keeping it intact. What's the crux of this issue?
It has to do with the penalty for the individual mandate, which Congress, of course, rescinded. And what the lawsuit claims is this, that when the Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act originally back in 2012, Chief Justice Roberts ruled that the individual mandate penalty was constitutional as equivalent to a tax. But subsequently, Republicans in Congress passed legislation zeroing out the penalty. The mandate itself technically still exists, but there's no penalty. So they argue that the mandate can no longer be legally equivalent to a tax because it's zero. And so far, so good, that seems right. But then what they argue is that the mandate is central to the rest of the law. And so if you rule that the mandate is now illegal because there's no penalty equivalent to a tax, then you have to rule that the rest of the law is illegal and should be thrown out. And that legal experts, I'm going to try and use a diplomatic word here early in the morning on NPR, but legal experts find that argument to be absolute nonsense because, of course, Congress retains the right as a sovereign body to revise its laws. So when Congress repealed the mandate penalty but kept the rest of the Affordable Care Act, that was the new Affordable Care Act. So actually, both liberal and conservative scholars agree that this lawsuit makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, but we've had federal judges rule in favor of the plaintiffs of the states in this case, one of them after he compared healthcare reform to a game of Jenga, and I'm not making that up, unfortunately. You know, legal qualifications don't determine what goes through the courts. And again, the courts are at this point another venue for partisan division, and that's what you see in this case.
What would happen, Julie, if the court decides to strike down the Affordable Care Act and the Affordable Care Act went away? Would we just return to where we were prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, or would the landscape, the healthcare landscape, change in some different way?
Well, the word that most people I've talked to use is chaos. It's not just that the exchanges would go away and those people would presumably no longer have insurance and people who got Medicaid through the expansion would no longer have insurance, but the Affordable Care Act was an enormous law that made a lot of other changes. It allowed for the approval of generic drugs for very expensive biologicals, they're called biosimilars. Would those drugs that have been approved no longer be approved because the pathway for approval would be taken away? The Indian Health Service was authorized in the law. There were so many things that are only sort of tangentially related to the main part of the law. Would Medicare and Medicaid regulations, many of which are premised on authorities created in the Affordable Care Act, would they cease to be? Would there be no longer any authority to pay Medicare or Medicaid bills? There are just an enormous amount of tentacles from the Affordable Care Act into the rest of the healthcare system, and nobody really knows what the impact would be.
Wow. So now we're in the throes of this epidemic, and that's going to throw us most likely into economic recession if we aren't already there. And this will be the first economic downturn, I believe, since the passage of the Affordable Care Act. Will its existence, Jonathan, help blunt some of the economic recession we may be facing? Because it's going to be paying for some of the things that a lot of hospital systems would not get paid for without this.
No question. It's going to help millions of Americans who lose their jobs and were not for the Affordable Care Act would have no affordable option to find health insurance. And it is, as you rightly say, going to help healthcare institutions who are struggling right now. It's not just that COVID-19 is creating very expensive care. It's that a lot of what healthcare systems do in terms of elective procedures, which generate a lot of revenue, they can't do right now. So the Affordable Care Act is going to help. At the same time, I think some of the limitations of the Affordable Care Act, particularly in the marketplace and those plans and the high cost sharing that we've been talking about, are likely to be amplified in coming months.
A lot of people who oppose Bernie Sanders' idea of Medicare for all or the idea of universal health care say it would bankrupt the country, Julie. Will this pandemic prove them perhaps to be wrong?
Well, we'll see. I mean, one of the arguments against the Bernie Sanders Medicare for All is that nobody would basically have to pay anything for any kind of health care. And there's a concern that with, you know, everybody talks about people having skin in the game. With no skin in the game, there's a concern about overuse. Right. Obviously, with people without insurance, there's a concern about underuse. I mean, this debate is sort of finding the right sort of medium. But I have been saying for the last couple of weeks that I think this really is going to change people's attitudes about the healthcare system. In what way, I'm not sure. We're seeing struggles on both the private sector side and the government side to deal with this, and certainly the coordination of the two. So who knows what people will come out mistrusting more.
Well, that was going to be my next question. I'll ask it of both of you, because we have this pandemic that's going to push millions of otherwise healthy individuals into the healthcare system for much needed critical care. Will this be the moment in America and American history that the people will decide that access to healthcare that doesn't bankrupt people will begin to be seen not as a political issue, but as a practical way to keep the nation healthy and productive? I'll start with you, Julie.
Well, I think this is a public health crisis, and I think most people don't think about public health very much. They take it as a given that we have clean water and relative in most places and relatively clean air, and that there are vaccines and treatments for most contagious diseases. This is obviously something very different, and I do think it's going to make people think about healthcare in a different way.
Jonathan, get the last word.
Yeah, I agree with Julie. I think this is going to redefine healthcare reform around public health, and those two really have not been connected all that much. At the same time, I don't think it's going to end the politics. I don't think it's going to end the partisanship, unfortunately. But I would hasten to add that I don't think popular opposition is the main reason why we don't have universal health insurance. We've had plenty of periods where the public has supported universal health insurance. So the question is, not just is this going to change people's attitudes, but how much is this going to change partisan divisions and stakeholder opposition as well?
Dr. Jonathan Oberlander is professor of health policy and management at the UNC Chapel Hill Gilling School of Global Public Health and the chair of the Department of Social Medicine there. And Julie Ravner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thank you both for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.